Welcome to episode 78 of the Extra Sequential Comics / Pop Culture / Shambolic Ramblings podcast. My name is Chris. I am representing the fine people of Perth, Western Australia. And representing Melbourne, Victoria is my good friend.
Oh, is that my cue? Maladen. How have you been, Chris? There across the continent.
Pretty good. It's still, a bit hot over here. Is it raining over there? Or
it is not raining. It's been cycling between rain and hot weather and cool weather. And it seems like a typical Melbourne summer from what I've gathered, although it's my first summer here. Fingers crossed we get some cold weather soon. I love my cold weather, Chris. I know you might be more of a warm weather kind of guy. You like shorts and things.
I'm with you. I do like the cold because then I can wear my fleecy Superman PJs.
Impress the roommates. So on this week's show, Chris, we're not talking about our PJs, although we could do that on another episode, I guess. This week's show, we're talking about creators working outside their comfort zones. What this means is basically putting out different work that you might not expect of them. Say if Grant Morrison put out an instructional gym exercise video, that would be putting out work outside of his typical sphere of creative work. And sometimes it's a pleasant surprise, other times it's not, but it definitely makes you sit up and notice when a creator who you think you have pegged goes and surprises you in a sometimes spectacular way.
Yes, and we've got quite a few varied examples of said creators doing just that.
And we'll be happy to get into those after a short news segment. Now, there's one news item that seems to have the whole internet a Twitter, and I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on it, even though I'm not hugely keen to talk about it until the books are out. I think you know what I'm talking about here.
Yes. Watchmen is 986, 87 miniseries, Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons, and DC had rights to it for ages since then because they've kept it in print, whereas Alan Moore wanted the rights to revert to him, and he hasn't liked anything that they've been doing with it, especially the movie. So after a couple of years of rumours, we now have it confirmed that, yes, DC are launching the Before Watchmen in the next few months. There's an interview with J. Mark Straczynski, one of the main writers, and we'll put all the necessary links up, but effectively there's going to be seven prequel miniseries focusing on the different characters like Dr. Manhattan, Night Owl, Comedian, etc. And then there's going to be the backup stories. And so all up, there's going to be, I think, 35 different issues, including a Before Watchmen epilogue. But, yeah, we've got some pretty good artists. We've got Brian Azzarello, writer's artists. We've got Darwin Cook doing the Minutemen 62 miniseries. Brian Azzarello's doing a couple. Len Wong. Amanda Connor's doing the art for the Silk Spectre miniseries. Ozzie Mandias is written by Len Wein with art by Jay Lee. So they're pretty good. They're all fantastic artists. But yeah, as you can imagine, a lot of people are like, how dare you? And it's going to make money, undoubtedly.
Yeah, it'll definitely make a lot of money. It's been fun to watch how people have been reacting either very, like, some strangely, not strangely positive. It's not wrong to be looking forward to this, but kind of angry that Alan Moore has the gall to be, a little bit critical of this or anything like that, and as well as people who've taken it to the other extreme of saying, this is sacrilege and this should have never happened and how dare they. I'm curious to hear where you fit in, Chris. What's your opinion?
I guess it doesn't tarnish Watchmen, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't tarnish the actual work, and Watchmen is one of the finest pieces of artists of comics or not. So, I mean, that'll always be there, and it's not going to tarnish that. And I think there is heaps of possibilities. I mean, obviously, it would be awesome if Alan Moore was involved, because these are his kids and he created them. Dave Gibbons, who's the original co-creator, he's on it as well, and I think so is the original colorist. It's going to be interesting, and it does reek of his desperation to make money, which I can understand from a purely business standpoint. I'm cautiously optimistic, but it does seem a bit odd, I must admit, but not a complete surprise. I don't know how I feel. I guess once the books come out, like I said, we'll have more of an idea. But these are all talented creators, and they all love the work. So, and I think there's a lot of potential. And hopefully the best bet, the best case scenario is that it brings more people back into comic shops, really.
I've heard people say that specifically, you know, it'll bring more people in. I read an interesting comment over at Seekart, I think that's how you pronounce it, S-E-Q, like sequential art. And the comment there was, I don't care if it brings people in if the comics they're buying are crap. He'd rather they not come into a comic store, which I understand that viewpoint. We don't know if this will be crap. I mean, it's too early to even comment on this. But as an idea, it's yes. curious that, I mean, Watchmen was always a kind of, it's a deconstruction of superhero books and companies like DC and Marvel and how they work, I guess. And then to spin that anti-commercial project into a very commercial project is a bit unusual, but I guess they're aware of it and they know that this will be controversial. And if anything, DC and Marvel like a bit of controversy baiting. So it absolutely makes sense. You know, they'd rather have people talking about something venomously than not talking about them at all. I don't know if I'll be picking these up just because I haven't read a DC or Marvel comic in a fair while now. And this doesn't lure me over there specifically, I guess. But hey, you know, Watchmen 2, directed by Zack Snyder, this is material I'm sure they're going to try and adapt into a film.
But the original film, which came out in 2009, 10, didn't make a whole lot of money, unfortunately, just because people outside of comics didn't know what to do with it. So I can't see them making a sequel. But
unsuccessful films, get sequels all the time, and there's they do kind of count on the first film in a franchise to not make a huge amount of money. They figure the goodwill from the first one translates into the second one, which is why Spider-Man 3 made a lot of money. Much more than Spider-Man 2, even though it's a lesser film. I always call up that example. Yeah,
true.
Yeah.
Talking about Spider-Man, a couple of new trailers, obviously, during the Super Bowl, where the Patriots and the Giants ran around a field or something, I don't know, for the Avengers, which I believe opens in May. And you can see all the characters in the Avengers trailer, including Hulk and Hawkeye. I'm sure you've seen it already. And the same with the Amazing Spider-Man 3D trailer, which is being released later on in the year, I think July, by Sony as well, came out a couple of days later. Both pretty good trailers, both exciting. Not being a huge Marvel fan myself, but always been more of a DC guy. But yeah, they both look pretty good. So the Spider-Man one in particular looks like a pretty interesting reboot, nothing to do with Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire. And it's got Andrew Garfield from The Social Network in it. So, yeah, that actually looks like quite a good couple of films there.
I'm eager to get into this topic, though, Chris, if you are.
I like enthusiasm. Let's do it.
Now, when we talked about this topic, how did you approach it? Like, how did you go about selecting people? What was your criteria?
The last few years have seen a lot of indie writers and or artists make their way to the mainstream, so a lot of those guys jumped to mind, and then I was just kind of looking at my bookshelf and kind of saying, you know, yeah, well, this is unusual. This is so the first guy I picked, which I'll talk about later, Frank Miller and Jeff Darrow's Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot, which is a kind of an all-ages tale from the creator of 300 and Sin City. And in a similar vein is Tayo, which came out late last year and has a sequel on the way by Brian Michael Bendis and Mike Avenomi, the creators of the more hardcore crime meets superpowers world of Powers. So those are the first two obvious ones. But I did have a couple that I wanted to talk about that just sprang to mind when we talked about this topic of artists or writers doing things they normally wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that came to mind is Chuck Dixon. We're talking about Chuck Dixon again. We gave him his own episode a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
He's the guy that did a lot of Batman work for DC in the 90s. He's actually been writing Simpsons comics for Bongo since 1998 on and off, so that's quite a departure for him. I'm pretty sure I haven't read any of his comics, Simpsons comics, but he must be a funny guy if he's been writing for them for that long. I did also want to mention Jeff Lemire. He's done a lot of work. He kind of started with his work with Top Shelf, with his Essex County trilogy. I don't know if you're that familiar with him, but he does the kind of black and white, painterly style, kind of Midwestern town drama, kind of growing up, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Essex County was recognised as one of the 10 best Canadian, I think, fiction for youth of the last 10 years. Like, that's including books and so forth. So it's quite a well-known book and quite easy to get now because Jeff Lemire, as you're about to say, has been getting a higher and higher profile.
Yes, yeah, there's three books in the Essex County, and they're all very good. And yes, so he got noticed, and then he started writing Sweet Tooth, which is with Vertigo, and he went on to write a one-shot for DC Comics of Atom, and then before the New 52 relaunch, he was writing Superboy, which surprised a lot of people. Okay, you kind of get a more indie creator working on franchise as Superboy, and then after the DC relaunch, he's been writing two a superhero series of DC, which is Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, and Animal Man, which I think we both read the first issue of at least. So, yeah, Jeff Lemire, he's, as seems to be happening more and more, I guess it's the same, isn't it? Like TV stars become movie stars and whatever. So I guess it's the same kind of thing in the comics. Independent writers and artists get noticed by their, I guess, Marvel and DC see these guys, and they may not know a lot about, you know, when his first love was or where Batman got shot in Detective Comics 827 or whatever, but they bring that storytelling sensibility and they work with characters. So I guess Marvel and DC are kind of scouting some of the smaller publishers for that kind of look. And I guess another obvious one, which is launched this week, is Brian Wood and Becky Cloonan on Conan the Barbarian 1, which is based on Robert E. Howard's Queen of the Black Coast storyline, which is, I think, published in 1934 originally, one of the first Conan stories, where Conan was a much younger man. And when they were announced, it surprised a lot of people because they've done work on Demo and other stuff.
They've worked together on Northlanders, which when I heard he was doing Conan, I thought immediately, okay, Northlanders, I could see this happening. Brian Wood tends to be kind of lumped into this category of writers who only write modern-day fiction, which isn't the case at all. He's written quite a bit of period stuff he's much more versatile than people give him credit. So it's nice to see him getting a few fun licensed titles like Conan to work on. Is this his first licensed work, though? I'm trying to think.
You could be right. I know he's also doing some Wolverine work for Marvel this year, I'm pretty sure. I don't think that's been announced yet. But, so he's another one that's kind of proved his versatility. And I should point out that I've reviewed Conan the Barbarian on Broken Frontier, and I'll put that link on the website as well. But, yeah, it's a very good comic. So, those were kind of three, Chuck Dixon, Jeff Lemire, and Wooden Cloonan. Mm-hmm. What examples do you have there, young Lucas?
Well, when I was thinking through this topic as an idea, I guess the only way it works is if the writer or the artist has a recognisable style or a recognisable voice that they always return to. Yes. There's quite a few versatile writers, and it's unfair to say that they even have a comfort zone because they like to push themselves. So it's not fair to bring up someone, I don't know, who just writes a huge variety of different work, whereas it's nice to, say, bring up someone like Frank Miller. I'm pretty sure we talked about him in the lead-up to this show, who I guess has a certain voice and then sometimes can create a surprising work. Yeah, you mentioned Rusty and I can't remember, Big Boy the Robot, I can't remember the name.
Close enough.
I've never read it, but I am a huge fan of Jeff Darrow, so I probably love that comic. And I've got Frank Miller on my list as well. But it can be a double-edged sword, can't it? I mean, you can alienate your core audience, or it can attract people at the idea of, ooh, this guy's doing something different, unexpected.
Yes, and I guess that's good. A lot of creators, I guess, get stuck into superheroes. I mean, there are some writers and artists that won't do anything except superheroes for Marvel and DC.
That's where the money is, I guess, though.
For years and years and years. But, yeah, that's the biggest market. Well, since you brought up a big guy, Rusty the Boy Robot, I might just talk.
Let's just start there,
Talk about that then.
Tell me about this comic.
So this was published in it's actually pretty good. It's published by Dark Horse Comics in 1995. Originally, it was two oversized individual issues, just a two-part story. Now, the easiest way to find it is as one big 80-pager kind of oversized. I don't know, maybe two or three times bigger than your normal comic. And it's interesting because this was published in 1995, which is the same time smack bang when Sin City was in its full swing. So Frank Miller did Sin City from 1991. You might remember the Sin City movie, which I kind of liked. It's probably the most faithful comics adaptation ever filmed, really. And the comics are pretty awesome and violent and very noirish and deadly. Lots of sex and blood and stuff. There's none of that here. But it's interesting, the same time period, Sin City's A Dame to Kill For won the Best Limited Series, Eisner. Yeah, this is set in Japan, and there's a bunch of scientists, including a talking monkey called Jenny, and they're recreating the primordial ooze that created the Earth. And they unwittingly create this yellow lizard-like Godzilla monster who promptly calls them fools and escapes the lab and wreaks havoc on Tokyo. He eats people and cars, and then he spits this goo onto people or the city, so they become little dinosaur creatures like him. It's actually, it's kind of got that Frank Miller flourish, even though it is pretty much an all-ages story. And it did get adapted into a cartoon, which I'll talk about later. But it's got his typical flourishy captions, let me give you an example.
Yeah.
And so the monster's unholy mission is revealed, not simply to destroy, not simply to hunt and eat, but to erase the human mind from the face of the earth, to make drooling, snarling beasts of every living being, beasts or slaves to a single hateful mind, old beyond imagining, evil beyond words. Block by block, the hideous, gurgling army grows, first by dozens, then by hundreds, then by thousands. Is there nothing that can stop it? And it's got...
Before you move on, that quote could have fit comfortably in Holy Terror.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that was... it's funny to see even approaching laugh-like material, which he obviously finds tongue-in-cheek, he approaches it in a similar way to how he does something very serious... Well, in his mind, is approached very seriously in Holy Terror, although that's arguable. You can check out our episode on Holy Terror for a review on that. Sorry, go on.
Very true. And it's accompanied with Jeff Darrow's highly detailed art that you talked about, I think, in Hard Boiled, which we've both read. And unfortunately, I guess Shaolin Cowboy, but he doesn't really do a lot of comics these days. I think he did conceptual artwork for the Matrix films, didn't he?
Yeah, that sounds right.
If serves me correctly. Mm. It's very detailed, lots of scenes of destructions, but it's not Jeff Darrow's typical style either. This is really toned down for the kid. Even though there's cars flying around and people getting changed into hideous creatures, there's no decapitations or blood or people vomiting or any of his typical kind of stuff. This Godzilla-like creature is destroying Tokyo, and then the military asks Rusty the boy robot, who's kind of like Astro Boy with a little red hair and a little Superman type coif, or maybe Tintin-esque, who's got nucleoprotonic power, for help. So Rusty is like, yes, cool, finally my first adventure, and he's all, kind of gung-ho, and he wants to win, so they'll make more like him, and he won't be so lonely. Eventually, the Japan's leaders struggle with asking for help because they realise that, Rusty can't win, so they use this communicator that they got from the US president. And under the Persian Gulf, the big guy, who's basically kind of like the Iron Giant movie, remember that, kind of like this big, shiny... Iron Man-esque silver thing rises up. Kind of reminds me of that Godzilla cartoon, 70s, early 80s, from the late 80s.
Chris, can I ask, are you going to...
on an aircraft carrier?
Are you going to spoil this entire comic?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Anyone who hasn't read it, Chris is reading out the entire plot from page one to the end. So, okay. Fair warning.
From 1995, if you haven't read it now. So, yeah, it's kind of reminds me of that old Godzilla cartoon where they called Godzilla with a whistle or something, I seem to recall. Anyway, so Big Guy and Rusty kind of show up and fight the lizard, but they never actually team up together until the last few pages, which is kind of interesting, even though the title's got their name on it. Mainly it's Big Guy doing most of the fighting, and Rusty the Boy Robot kind of shows up in the first few pages and the last few. There's a few extras with pin-ups, also done by Jeff Darrow, featuring Ash and Spawn, and also who were popular characters at the time. And that's why it's still popular. And mock covers from the Big Guy Rusty Bell Robot comics that never existed in the 50s and 70s, showing them fighting such adversaries as Moonpig, Comrade Croc, Dr. Spiderhead, and Captain Chernobyl. I really like this book. As I said, there was a cartoon as well. 26 episodes were done from 1999 to 2001. Fun facts, Mladen, starring the voices of Gabrielle Carteris, who you might remember from Beverly Hills 90210, Kathy Kinney, who you might remember as Minnie from The Drew Carey Show, and also starring Tom Hanks' brother, Jim.
That cast list doesn't impress me hugely, I've got to say.
Oh, that's why I mentioned it. But I don't remember seeing the cartoon when it came out, but apparently it's on DVD. But I did one of the things that was interesting. This was actually quite... The 90s was a hugely diverse time for Frank Miller. Like, he was doing, all this Star Wars stuff. I think 300 was about the same time. Martha Washington, obviously, he's done a lot of stuff in his time. He's done Dead, Sin City, we mentioned Dark Knight Returns. Mm-hmm. So Frank Miller is quite a diverse... creator, but yeah, the 90s, he was quite diverse.
Yeah, he hadn't quite settled down into what people expected of him at that stage. I remember, I don't remember at the time, but when I first got into, because I wasn't into comics at that point in the early 90s, Frank Miller, when I first started reading about him, there is this kind of very creative period for him, and then you see books like, Rusty the Big Boy Robot, and Martha Smith?
Washington.
Yeah,
goes Martha Stewart. Martha Washington.
Yeah, sorry. I can't think. Mr. Smith goes to Washington. That's what I'm confusing this with. but And then eventually he would sort of become the Frank – well, it was, he was always the Frank Miller we knew, but he just settled into writing the same story over and over and over again. So that's almost one in the opposite sense. He started off writing outside of any kind of comfortable zone because he was still pushing himself, and then he settled into a little niche that he likes, and that's all he writes in now. And you sort of see that shift in around, I guess the year 2000 is when you start to go, okay, you can you pretty much know what to expect from Frank Miller. I have a book by him that never came out, but it was talked about quite a bit. It's called Jesus, and I say it that way because there's an exclamation point in the title. And this was due to come out from Dark Horse. And it was announced, I think, in August of 2000. Frank Miller was talking about it. He said, and this was while he was writing and drawing Dark Knight Strikes Again, and no one had seen that book yet. So I think people were still positive and hopeful that that would be cool, yet to be disappointed. But he said he was doing a lot of reading and preparing, and he mentions, it's certainly the toughest job I've ever given myself. And Diana Schultz was saying she'd been reading some of the texts, and it's remarkable how this story, familiar to people the world over, can take on a brand new light, or even several, depending on who's doing the telling. So from what we can gauge from that, it was probably going to be different viewpoints, probably Judas telling the story, you know, that kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Dark Horse spokespeople were saying it's going to be a respectful, history-inspired look at the life of Jesus, neither irreverent nor reverent in tone. But nothing came of it, which was, I guess, not unsurprising. I think a few years later, in 2004, the film The Passion of the Christ came out. And I'm guessing that took some of the wind out of Frank Miller's sails, because I can imagine that his work would have been quite a few pages of Jesus being flogged with blood splatters, in very artistic blood splatters, you know, chiaroscuro, you know, black and white artwork. But, I mean, he took a topic which you would not really expect him to tackle, and in my imagination he would have done it in a way that is very comfortable for him. I can't see him pushing himself too far out of that Frank Miller zone and writing a book that's very un-Frank Miller-ish, if that makes sense.
True.
So that's one that almost happened. Maybe it's best that we never got this book. Or then again, you know, it could have been wonderful. You can look it up. There's no photos. There's no pictures. He never released anything of it, unfortunately. Lazy Frank Miller. Lazy.
Have you got another book that did come out?
Yeah, I do, actually. I've got two more here that I want to talk about, and they're both manga, so that works for me. Katsuhiro Otomo. Now, he wrote and illustrated, probably most well-known for Akira, which was a huge cult classic in the early 90s in the West, but came out, I think, in 89 in Japan. And it's fair to say that in his writing, he was always pretty... he liked exploring different concepts and different ways to do them, but he's quite, I guess, most well known for tales of, I guess, teenage protagonists, quite bloody tales. There's usually psychics involved, you know, psychic powers, and so violence, action, very, very action packed, very adult, drugs, sex, you know, all that kind of stuff. And always like the urban environment plays a major part. His books have a very particular look and feel and tone and approach, as does his anime, because he's shifted to directing over the last few years. But he released a book called Hipira, The Little Vampire, with Shinji Kimura as the artist. And to give you a feeling, Shinji Kimura was one of the background artists on My Neighbor Totoro. So those two guys smushed together isn't quite the first thing you'd think of. It's a cute little vampire story, I should say. It's about a little vampire boy who lives in Vampire Town, and he plays pranks. And the darkest story in the book involves him helping his granddad collect the souls of humans to open a vortex to hell. But this hell is like heaven for vampires, so it's much more played positively. But the approach is very Tim Burton-esque, if you've seen Tim Burton's doodles and the kind of stories he tells, like Frankenweenie. Did you ever see that one, that short animated film he made? Or Nightmare Before Christmas-esque, although he was just the producer on that, but it has his fingerprints all over it. Tim Burton, I should say. If you hadn't told me this was Katsuhiro Otomo, I don't think I would have picked it. There's an animated series based on it too, and it's as adorable. I mean, it's really well told. It's actually an entertaining comic. But this is just someone who's just gone, okay, let's do something completely different. And I can't tell if it was for commercial reasons or if he just felt, I've got this story about an adorable vampire in me. I mean, is this one you're familiar with, Chris? Or have you never... Dark Horse published it in English, I should mention.
No, I've never heard of it.
Mm. It usually gets put in the children's book section, which is not somewhere you'd look for Otomo again, which is strange. Another manga artist who, again, you might expect a certain thing from is Junji Ito. If you don't know his work, he specializes in horror manga. I've lent Chris some of his stuff before, and you told me you enjoyed it, unless if you were lying.
I don't lie to you.
He does... I'm trying to think of a way to describe it. His take on horror is much more psychological and, I guess, body horror, grotesque images rather than blood splattering everywhere. He's more of a Cronenberg than a John Carpenter. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's his approach. So he'll come up with wild, insane, horrific ideas like a town attacked... obsessed with spirals or fish growing legs and walking out of the water, which as an idea is horrible, and it's horrible enough, and that's a great one by him. So then I was surprised to find he'd written and illustrated a cat diary. It's called Junji Ito's Cat Diary, and it's about him and his wife adopting two cats. That's kind of it. And it's the way it's approached, though, is so different. He still uses his trademark look and the way, so if you came in knowing his work, this reads like one of his books. Like the way they react to Hirohi reacts to the cat liking his wife more than him is played the same way as a character working out that there's monsters among them, you know, in one of his other manga. There's still those horrific close-ups of like sunken eyes going no. And one of the cats is cursed, or so he thinks, because it has the pattern on its back which looks like a skull. But this is like a true story, by the way. He took pictures of the cat. I think they adopted it because it has this pattern. So for a horror writer to find a cat with an entertaining pattern on its coat is quite fitting. But yeah, there's just, it's so funny to see this stuff, which is horrifying in his other comics, work so well as a comedy, like the horror when she tells him, do you want to adopt cats? And then the close-up on his face as he's grinning his teeth going, yes, okay, I would love to have some cats. And he's powerless to resist their adorable charms, even though he's like, I don't want these cats. Yeah, it's... He draws his wife's eyes with, like, evil white pupils for no reason. You can tell he's just cracking himself up with every sequence. Like there's one where he opens the door and the cat's just waiting for him on the front step, and then he slams it like, no! Yeah, it's an unusual one. I'd recommend it for anyone who's read his horror work, because you will get such a laugh out of this. And I know that early in his career he drew quite a bit of gag manga, which was never collected, I don't think, in English. So this is a nice way to see this other aspect of his personality, which isn't all about terrifying you. Yeah, that's Junji Ito's Cat Diary, I believe, has come out in an English volume, which you can find. So it hopefully is still in print. If the publisher hasn't gone out of business in today's climate, that's very possible. But Chris, nice. I would suggest you read this. I think you'd get a good laugh out of it, especially because I know you're not a cat person.
Correct.
And the main character, Junji Ito himself, obviously is not a cat person. And it's very funny on the pages seeing how he has to deal with them. I'd, recommend this comic.
Sounds hilarious. My last example is not as funny as that, but still, I guess, kind of all ages. But also, this one's, I guess this one's unusual because of the genre, I guess, or the approaches. An all-ages book published by Marvel's Icon imprint, which is their creator-owned imprint that Kick-Ass and a few other series were originally published by. This is by writer Brian Michael Bendis, who most people know from Ultimate Spider-Man and his miscellaneous All and Sundry Avengers titles. He's been Marvel's golden boy and their main writer for the last 10 or so years. And artwork by Mike Avon-Oeming. They also together created Powers, which may or may not become a TV series if the pilot, which is just filmed, gets successfully rejigged. But this is called Takio. Came out late last year. The sequel is actually because it was so successful. The sequel is actually coming out, well, the first issue is out a reason later, obviously a trade paperback. It centres on two kid sisters. You never see their mum's face. It centres mainly on them. It's called, the kid sisters are Taki, T-A-K-I, who's the older one, who I think, and if he serves me correctly, is also the name of Mike Avon Oeming's wife, and Olivia, who's her younger sister, and their mutual friend, Kelly Sue. It basically just follows them around at school and, you know, the two kids arguing. And being a typical Brian Michael Bendis book, it is quite talky. But being an atypical Brian Michael Bendis book, it's not deep and meaningful and dark and kind of filled with, you know, quirky comments and superheroes that everyone, you know, speaks like they're from Buffy, you know, very witty and whatnot. So this is pretty, you know, one of the girls that lives with us here, one of the young girls, was kind of flicking through it today, and it does kind of look like a kid's book, really. It's got that kind of smaller format, hardbound. But yeah, basically it focuses on, yeah, Taki and Olivia, their friend Kelly Sue. Kelly Sue's dad works for GloboSurge, which is this big, well, company, I guess, and he just got fired just before his main scientific breakthrough, and his wife has just left him. So he's kind of one of these typical unhinged scientists about to show the world how awesome he is. So the two sisters go and visit Kelly Sue, and her dad's experiment blows up and covers them all with electricity and giving them powers, or which they call kung fu telekinesis. The dad basically so shows up claiming that he made them and owns them, and his goons kind of attempt to take them in. And Olivia, the younger girl, is very excited, like, yeah, we can finally be superheroes. So she makes costumes for them, and she comes up with a tachyon name for them, which is the combination of Taki and Olivia. But they also discover that Kelly Sue, who was their kind of friend, also gained the same powers. So, and she kind of blames the sisters for, yeah, putting their dad in jail. So yeah, shenanigans afoot there. But it is an all ages comic. That it's not your kind of feel be the typical Brian Michael Bendis angst, which he writes in a lot of his superhero comics. There's a lot of, it's quite a breezy read, quite lighthearted. A bit of humour in places, and it's really good. He writes the sisters' dialogue quite well. I think he's got quite a few bits for himself. Yeah, it's kind of quite good in that regard. But yeah, I really quite enjoyed it. So yeah, the sequel's coming out. The first issue's out in May. But yeah, I recommend picking it up. It's called Tachio, and it's available now. I'll tell you, I've got a quote here actually from Brian Michael Bendis. He did a recent interview, and it says, it's so funny because I've been putting together the solicits, which is like the advertising, I guess the ordering information you see in previews. I've been putting together the solicits for Powers and Tachio. Powers is noir and oppressive. It's full of shadows that punish the characters. Tachio is all about excitement. It's almost like the art itself is looking forward to something. It's full of exuberance. So, yeah, if you want something all ages and you want to see Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Avon Oeming do something different than they usually do, pick up Tachio.
That sounds good. It seems like a lot of these examples might be writers and artists who normally work in serious realm then doing either something all ages or something more, I don't want to say family friendly, but I guess just more upbeat than what we normally expect from them. Would that be fair?
Yes.
I wonder
that
why.
Is true, yeah. And I did think about it.
I'm trying to think of some examples that go the other way. Can you think of any that go the other way? Someone who works in primarily in comedy or family friendly?
Kind of. I've got Mark Wade. He's been doing his series, which both end in May for Boom Studios, Irredeemable. Mm-hmm. So the 37th issue is out, which is the final one, and the spin-off Incorruptible, the 30th issue, is out as well. That started in 2009. So these basically, Mark Wade, I've got another quote from here. Mark Wade, I'm really truly grateful for the chance to go and create a world where I was able to, on a monthly basis, challenge some fans' perception of me as some sort of Silver Age fetishist unable to break through into the 21st century. Mark Wade is a historian. He loves DC Comics. He knows all about, you know, Superman. He's written Superman, you know, Justice League. He's written Fantastic Four. He wrote Kingdom Come. And he has such a love of the kind of Silver Age characters, like from the 50s and 60s. And he's the kind of go-to guy to kind of, I guess he's kind of similar to like DC's version of Brian Michael Bendis in some way, but without all the angst. He kind of writes witty characters that you care for. And he's got such this love of all the crazy wackiness, you know, like all the super pets and stuff. So he's always had this kind of reputation, whereas Irredeemable, from Boom Studios, ending, as I said, in May, it's what if Superman turned bad, and it's pretty dark. I only read the first half a dozen issues, but it's very dark. Incorruptible is a spin-off of Irredeemable where the villain becomes a good guy, And yeah, I remember when the marketing came out for this, you know, 3-4 years ago, Mark Waid is evil. And it was like so surprising because Mark Waid's known as the kind of the nice guy in the comics industry. And so I was like, what is this? Mark Waid is evil. So yeah, these are very dark, very dark. So I guess that's the closest I can think of someone who usually has a happy temperament in his comics writing to go, yeah, surprisingly dark with Irredeemable and Incorruptible. But I can't really think of any others. And that's because I don't read a lot of all-ages comics, and I guess you don't either.
No, I mean, there's a few cases I guess I can think of, say, no, but it's still played for laughs. I was thinking of, you know, Marvel's Strange Tales or the Star Wars Tales comics where they would get a few unexpected contributors like Peter Baggy or Tony Millionaire.
Yeah.
There's quite a few in the new Strange Tales, which is a fun comic to pick up from Marvel right now, actually. Lots of independent artists kind of taking quirky looks at the known characters, I guess. But yeah, it doesn't seem to go the other way. Maybe, I guess there's always commercial pressures on someone. You know, once people are used to them creating a certain type of work, you don't want to, once you've worked hard enough to make that image for yourself, you don't want to change it unless if you feel like that image of you is unnecessarily stifling or you didn't enjoy it to begin with. See, Frank Miller, I'm sure, is very happy in the world he's in now, whereas someone like Brian Wood would be, I guess, more eager to push the boundaries of what people expect of him. I mean, yeah, those are just some examples, I guess. I'm sure there's plenty more if people can think of them. They should hit us up on the Existential Facebook site. In general, I think I far prefer writers and artists who tend to not be in there in a very predictable, you know. So cases like these, it isn't always a positive thing because it does imply that there's a certain predictability in their work, and that's not a positive aspect for it, unless if you're writing pulp or something, you know, and people
I guess I mean I guess a lot of these writers and artists know what they're good at and they stick to it, you know. They know, I mean, it takes quite a specific skill to write superhero stuff as compared to other stuff, I guess. But people like Jeff Lemire and have proven that you can kind of do both. And Brian Michael Bendis,
Jason Aaron's a good example.
That's true.
Yeah, he started obviously on Scalped, and then he was kind of lured into working on Wolverine, and I'm sure he's working on another
Ghost Tribe.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and I guess the money is an alluring aspect of why people find themselves pigeonholed, and then maybe try and break out of it later, because when the paychecks are coming in.
Yeah. That's true, and I guess also it's more creatively satisfying for writers and artists to vary their work that they're doing, so they're not drawing the same spandex clad people, you know, punching each other each time they sit down at the keyboard or drawing board. So I guess I can understand that. It's the same reason why, I don't know, musicians go solo or actors try and do something unexpected. But I mean, I think any of these examples that we've spoken of today, they don't scream of people, of the creators desperately trying to show that they've got other strings to their bows. I think, you know, they all prove quite well that you can work in any kind of approach or genre, I would say.
Yeah, they're usually very skillfully done. It's a shame they're one-offs in some cases. You kind of want them to keep exploring those different aspects.
Yes, thank you for listening. And yeah, as Milana said, if you have any examples, shoot us an email, chris@existentialsequential.com, or on Facebook. And please, yeah, continue to let us know if you want us to talk about the comic news or what we've been reading or both at the top of the show. Thank you for listening as always. Find us on existentialsequential.com and iTunes, I guess.
Music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. And if you... I'm throwing this out there because I've had a lot of fun on it so far. If you are an Australian artist and or maybe you're rusty and you haven't drawn in a long time, head over to a site called ozcomics.com or look them up on Facebook, and they have a weekly draw-off challenge, and it's very friendly and people of all sorts of skill levels, you know, from raw beginners to very good artists are there. Just trying that right now. The topic is Watchmen, so people are doing all sorts of Watchmen fan art, and it's been fun to watch.
And you've done a couple of good ones, and we should point out that it's OZ Comics,
right? US. Of course, yeah, not Austrian comics, my friends.
No,
Australia. Thanks everyone, and you'll hear us next week. Bye
bye.